Welcome to CFRI's Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
Great. Well, thank you very much for that introduction. I'm really happy to be here. This is my first time interacting with the CFRI group, other than from afar. So it's really been inspiring so far, including yesterday evening hearing from Emily and Jerry. And in fact, I've thrown in a couple slides inspired from their talk to share with you today. I'm going to see if I can begin the presentation. Great. So in fact, to that end, I thought after hearing from Emily and Jerry about that, I might share where I had my first exposure to people with CF and became dedicated to that. And that was when I was sporting a little bit of a different hairstyle than I'm wearing today. It was, about 25 years ago, at least, where I was a counselor for children with special health needs in a variety of conditions. But included about a third of the individuals had cystic fibrosis, and that's where I really got connected to those young people, teenagers with CF, and have since made that a part of my career. Of course, I think we're all quite familiar with the understanding of the pathophysiology of CF, including how it is emerging, particularly on these important details and how we might intervene. Starting with the abnormal gene resulting in an abnormal protein, and ultimately setting up an abnormal environment on the surface of epithelial organs, and particularly the lung, where depletion of the airway surface liquid and abnormal mucus itself then confer significant disruptions in host defense, including prominently mucociliary clearance. And that sets up a cycle of destruction of injury and infection that goes on to progress to end-stage lung disease and what we seek to avoid. And of course, what I'm here to tell you a bit about today is how interventions early in this process have begun to make a pronounced difference in the lives of people with CF by addressing the abnormal protein. We know from a strong understanding of the molecular biology of cystic fibrosis that there are a variety of different CFTR mutations. There's only over 2,000 variants that have now been described, over 350 that have known to cause disease for certain. And that's obviously a challenging task for a therapeutic approach. However, you can simplify this strategy by breaking them down into their molecular cause. And in this relatively simplified version, you see that there are mutations that have little or no production. Those are called class 1 mutations. There's also those with a reduced amount of normal CFTR production. Those are class 5 or splicing mutations. There's also the most common mutation in cystic fibrosis, the delta F508 mutation, and a few mutations that are similar that are degraded in the proteasome and never reach their active site at the cell surface. And then there are mutations that do reach the cell surface but are dysfunctional, including gating mutations, such as the one we've quite familiar with in the G551D, as well as other conductance mutations that sit on the surface, transport some anions, but not to a sufficient degree to have a normal lives. And then there's also other minor defects like accelerated turnover. But now there's really therapeutic approaches to each of these groups of mutations that are at various stages of development. The CFTR potentiators are the furthest along. CFTR processing correctors are also approved and available for patients, and we're making major progress in this area for the delta F508 mutation to improve those further. And then there are translational read-through agents that are in both discovery campaigns as well as earlier stage development to address, hopefully, all mutations with CF. Well, one of those major advances that we heard a little bit about yesterday from Emily's experience was the development of ivacaftor, then VX-770, and now sold as Kalydeco. And in patients in this phase 3 trial that were randomized to receive ivacaftor versus placebo, you can see they had an immediate improvement in their lung function that was sustained over time. The magnitude of that benefit was substantial and really was a transforming nature of the field, including when it was accompanied by substantial improvements in the sweat chloride concentration, which of course we know is the diagnostic test for CF and one that parents of individuals with CF have long recognized as a way to identify children with CF. This was really hailed by Pam Davis as perhaps the end of the beginning, and I think now just under 10 years out from that event, we can see that that was relatively prescient. But for those working in the CF field, it was also, I think certainly the weight of that discovery also weighted us in the fact that this really was only affecting 5% of individuals with CF, with the vast majority of individuals harboring mutations that were not represented and therefore was a major challenge to those of us working in the field to help advance this further and bring availability to more individuals. One of the things that experience did, both in these data derived from the phase 2 testing, as well as subsequent studies, was provide a roadmap for how we might then take this knowledge from the ivacaftor experience and apply it to other individuals with CF. This is the relationship between sweat testing on the y-axis and CFTR function. In this case, measured by nasal potential difference, you could do this a variety of ways and the curve would change somewhat. But what you can see here is those with severe CF and pancreatic insufficient CF are at one end of the spectrum, while those who have no CFTR mutations and don't have CF are at the far end. And this is a nonlinear relationship. It's relatively steep on the left side of the curve, and that's true for many autosomal recessive diseases, where even small amounts of activity of a protein or the function that causes the disease can result in substantial improvements. And it's also why that even small amounts of improvement in CFTR activity can make a pronounced improvement in CF. You can see even 5% of CFTR activity can change you from pancreatic insufficient CF to pancreatic sufficient CF, which of course is much more mild, but not inconsequential. Well, if you populate this curve then with the experience with ivacaftor, you can see based on the relatively strong dose response relationship in individuals with G551D, first of all, almost remarkably, these dose groups fell right along the expected curve. And then secondly, based on the improvement in lung function and other outcome measures, we could start to define thresholds. For example, the amount of function generated to receive detectable improvements in CFTR activity and lung function and other outcomes was about 30%. And you can even push this lower if you were willing to accept smaller improvements in lung function and other parameters. So that really set forth the relative benchmark that was needed to be achieved in the laboratory and in early phase clinical testing to predict future success. Those lessons were then applied to the more common mutation, the F508, and there were several successful campaigns to then develop that. It started with the notion that first you had to bring CFTR to the cell surface, since the F508 mutation was destroyed before it reaches the cell surface, and then you had to superactivate it with a CFTR potentiator. And with a study termed traffic and transport that looked at one of these correctors, lumacaftor, combined with avacaftor, you can see that same sort of trend with an early improvement in lung function that then is sustained over the course of the 6-month study. Although it should be noted that the magnitude of this benefit was only about a third as what was seen with ivacaftor, just as one would predict from the laboratory values where ivacaftor and lumacaftor, four patient cells derived from F508 homozygous individuals, didn't respond nearly as well as ivacaftor, the response was seen in individual cells from G551D. This was repeated with an alternative corrector, tezacaftor, combined with avacaftor, with a very similar curve and a similar magnitude improvement. Again, also predicted based on that in vitro response. Of course, those are now available to many individuals with CF who are homozygous for F508, and resulting in improvements, but still not to the benchmark that we've now termed highly effective CFTR modulator therapy that's been set forth by the ivacaftor experience in G551D. Well, at that point, the basic scientists in the field were really trying to unravel how could this be achieved for this more common F508 mutation, and to reach the level of activity needed necessary for even patients who had only one copy of the F508. The potency and the efficacy of those agents would need to be better to try and achieve that. And it came from the knowledge that there was really two major problems in the folding and trafficking of CFTR. One, and it comes from the fact that the F508del mutation is positioned on a very specific part of this CFTR molecule. This is the CFTR molecule sitting in the membrane. The channel that allows chloride and bicarbonate to flow through it is here, and the engine that drives that CFTR molecule is below here by these nucleotide binding domains. And when they bind and hydrolyze ATP, the energy of the cell that allows these anions to flow. But the F508 mutation sits on an important component right where the engine interfaces with the channel. And when that fails, the channel really falls apart. And also, the engine itself does not engage the channel itself. So both of those aspects would have to be addressed to try and get much more normal levels of F508del CFTR to reach the cell surface. Again, two major problems. One, unfolding of the nucleotide binding domain that essentially makes the channel fall apart. And also the stability between the engine part and the channel part would need to be maintained. And what these sorts of laboratory data were able to show that if you engineer mutations that fix either the nucleotide binding domain folding or the domain assembly, how the two parts work together, you could see important increases in the yield of the protein. But you didn't necessarily get the full levels of CFTR expression. You had to address both problems. When both problems were then inserted, you could see that you could achieve this line of synergistic activity, ultimately nearly achieving that of the wild-type protein. So that really set forth the concept that if two drugs could be used, one to affect the folding and the other to affect channel assembly, that you could start to expect much more near normal levels of CFTR function and expression, even for this relatively difficult to treat F508del misfolding mutation. And it's now been shown that that is in the case, both in the laboratory and in proof of concept studies in the clinic, with the development of these triple combination molecules. They rely on two correctors, again, presumably to affect those two parts of the F508 folding and trafficking process, along with the potentiator ivacaftor. And those, an example of three different of those are shown in this bar graph and set in comparison to tezacaftor ivacaftor, the two drug combination in cells that are F508del. And I want to point out that these are actually a group of individuals who donated cells that were heterozygous for F508del. So they didn't have another allele, only the F508del is responsive to this. And despite that, using these three drug combinations, any of the three achieved the threshold set forth by the G551D experience with ivacaftor that's shown in the dotted line. So even in patients with one copy of F508del, you could start to expect a prominent response in the laboratory. And that was also shown to be true in the clinic. In phase two clinical testing of individuals with CF with two different forms of these molecules. This one is VX659, a sister molecule to VX445, which now has been taken forward in phase three trials and is also known by alexacaftor. And what you can see is in the clinic, this three drug combination in people with a F508del and a minimal function allele, so only a single F508del that's responsible for the response, that they had a substantial improvement in their sweat test and also an improvement in their lung function that was rapid, just as we saw before, and sustained a course of this 1 month study. And the magnitude was also substantial. Again, 10% being the threshold seen for the ivacaftor experience. And you can see the average improvements here are more between 13 and 14 milliequivalents. And it's been subsequently announced and right now being in the final analysis, that a phase three clinical trial with a sister molecule to these that tested this drug combination for 6 months had almost identical responses as this phase two experience, with on average of 13 to 14% improvement in FEV1, which we would say is a very prominent response, and also improvements in weight gain and other outcome measures that we expect to see when we flip the switch and turn on CFTR with a drug like ivacaftor in patients with G551D. So those final data will be presented in the coming months in the October meeting at the North American CF Conference, and we'll look forward to sharing that further experience with you. But it has been announced that those data are favorable enough that a submission to the FDA has been made just last week to bring this three-drug combination forward to individuals who have even a single F508del allele. And it's also been shown to be effective in individuals homozygous for F508del. In patients who are homozygous for F508del, the clinical study showed that when they remained on tezacaftor, ivacaftor, their lung function remained stable. However, if they were to go on to the three-drug combination, in this case with VX-6659, they had an improvement in their FEV1 of an additional 10%. So that's an additional 10% compared to what you'd expect to see from the tezacaftor-ivacaftor experience. They also had improvement in their quality of life measure. That was a large signal, as well as that expected reduction in sweat chloride testing reflective of improvement in CFTR activity. So I think this will really begin a phase of transformation. If we start to think about based on genotype and return to the pie chart, we can now imagine that the vast majority, approaching 90% of individuals based on their genotype alone, would be expected to benefit from this therapy as it's been tested so far. And we can also anticipate there'll be additional testing for other mutations, allowing many patients to benefit and to the level of magnitude that we've seen from this prior effective experience. This has also shown really how we stood just last year in the number of patients with modestly effective and highly effective CFTR modulator therapy, and then what we could expect once these approvals then commence. That doesn't mean there's not a serious challenge before us, and I'm going to be talking a bit about that in the second half of the talk on how we can attack that problem that remains a significant motivation for those of us working in the CF field. You know, one thing to point out is that there are a prominent number of groups, both pharmaceutical companies and academic groups, that are working on either similar molecules to help broaden their availability to individuals with CF, or alternative approaches even for more difficult to treat mutations, and I'll point out a little bit about that in the second half of the talk. Well, you know, one of the benchmarks that was set forth originally in a talk by Mike Constan when he helped develop ibuprofen for individuals CF, particularly adolescents with CF, as an anti-inflammatory molecule, was to point out that many of the therapies that had been made available to individuals with CF to date, including, for example, Pulmozyme and hypertonic saline, et cetera, had shown significant improvements in lung function. But if we could intervene earlier in the disease and affect the underlying pathophysiology and change the rate of decline, then you would really expect to garner prominent improvements in survival. And I now want to point out how that's begun to be the case as we have garnered more data. We've also, as a community of CF researchers, also used the ivacaftor experience to learn as much as possible about what we might expect. And this is just a long list of the various observations that have been made in people with G551D and other similarly responsive mutations who've gone on ivacaftor, including these improvements that we've already talked about in lung function, exacerbation rate, weight gain, and respiratory symptoms, but also underlying physiology in both the sweat testing, lung function decline, sweat rate testing, pH testing of the intestine, as well as some other that I'll point out in the next slide. One of the things that really surprised us in conducting the study called the GOAL study, which was a multi-center effort led by the Therapeutics Development Network, was a surprising, and really relied on patient volunteers after the approval of ivacaftor. So it really speaks to the fact that we had 150 individuals with CF that contributed to this study, all generously donating their time, not to get access to drug, but simply to help understand what might happen, is a really testament to the field. And one of the observations that came out of this group is that even that patients that grew Pseudomonas dropped after they started ivacaftor at 6 months and even 12 months after. This has actually been extended on to 24-month data, and we're analyzing the 5-year data as we speak. But what it really points out is it challenges the dogma in the field. The previous dogma had been, once you acquire a bad bug like Pseudomonas and it becomes mucoid, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to eradicate once established. And what this showed was that even in patients with some patients with mucoid Pseudomonas were able to eradicate their Pseudomonas once they went on to ivacaftor. And it points out that I think as we move forward with CF treatments and more individuals are on highly effective CF neuromodulator of this sort of benchmark, that I think we'll start to have opportunities to reverse their microbiological outcome. It's not certainly without challenge, and I think we'll need other drugs to help dislodge these bacteria to fully reach that goal. But I think it suggests that it is clearly possible and that we can begin to turn back the clock on disease progression. Another example that really speaks to this is what we've learned as we've gone on to younger and younger age groups and applied ivacaftor and even more recently ivacaftor or lumacaftor to the youngest children with CF. Of course, this has to be done very cautiously with specific dose dependence and safety studies to make sure appropriate levels are being achieved. But what has been seen, for example, in individuals that are age 2 to 5 in the G551D mutation, and you measure pancreatic elastase function, which is a measure of pancreas function in the GI tract, that you can see these 2 to 5-year-olds, some of them start to have elevation in their elastase levels in their intestine, including about 20% of individuals that get above this line here, which is a threshold that we would classically determine as pancreatic sufficient. So it suggests that an organ again, previous dogma has suggested that once you're born, your pancreas is really shot. You're not going to be able to restore its function. You'll need to have pancreatic enzymes for the rest of your life. That indeed may not be the case. If you can intervene early, flip the switch on CFTR, this is early evidence that you can start to restore organ function even from the pancreas. More recently, it's been shown that as you push the age even younger, in this case 12 to 24 months, 67% of the participants began to meet the pancreatic threshold. So as we intervene earlier and earlier, we can start to imagine a restoration of organ function. I think this is relatively dependent on the amount of injury in place rather than specific age. Younger people generally have less injury in place, so it's more likely to be restored. But even in an experience in adults with partially active CFTR mutations, we can start to see even a small blip on the signal on their fecal elastase levels. And that suggests that even in those patients who are adults, if their pancreas wasn't severely damaged, they have the potential to augment that pancreatic function. Obviously, there'll be more work to be done there. Another example of how the disease has the potential to transform is to look at rate of decline. This is the experience with ivacaftor after 2 years, and you can see that those individuals that received ivacaftor were compared to a control group of individuals who weren't eligible to receive CFTR modulator therapy, that you can see that not only did that have that big bump upwards, and as Emily described, have a new baseline, a new normal for them, but the rate that they were moving downward over time essentially was cut in half, or a 47% reduction in that rate of decline over time. Actually, even lumacaftor, ivacaftor, which is not as effective, doesn't have as big a bump upwards at the start of the drug, also represents a reduction in the rate of decline. So even more modest levels of CFTR function can have a prominent effect on the rate of decline, even if that initial bump upwards is not as prominent. It really points out, for those of us continuing to push the limits for CF therapy, how sensitive these benchmarks tend to be. This is the rate of decline at 4%, 3%, 2% per year, and even 1% per year. The average rate in the registry is about 2% per year. One might ask, well, if it's not so severe, are we really making a difference? What this graph is intended to point out is that even small changes, a 0.5% change, when you're starting from 2%, can make a very prominent change in the expected life expectancy based on the progression of disease. So I think we can still make very prominent gains even as we get closer and closer to normal rates of decline in cystic fibrosis. I think this really states what I just said, that even small amounts can make a big difference. And as we consider improved CFTR modulators, we need to be prepared to examine events over a long period of time. So it's going to continue to take dedication from individuals with CF and volunteering for these sorts of studies to ultimately measure their effects. And similarly, that these small degrees of activity may impart clinically relevant findings when given over a sufficient period of time, including those with less responsive mutations. And now I'm going to tell a story of a bit of that, where we're taking various CFTR modulators and applying them to people with CF that don't have the indicated mutation to see what might happen. Another effort that's being led by my colleague David Nichols, who's also in the audience, along with a number of investigators through the CF Therapeutics Development Network, is a study called PROMISE. It was really built on the GOAL experience as well as the more recent PROSPECT experience, where we're going to ask individuals to volunteer for additional testing, for research-grade testing, as the new triple therapy is approved. And we'll evaluate them in two phases, some early endpoints up through 6 months, along with a longer-term experience through 24 months, and measure a variety of outcome measures of other organ function that we might expect, some we've already mentioned, like mucus clearance, or GI health through the pH. But we'll also try to tap some unstudied areas where we're beginning to think that, again, flipping the switch might make an impact for people with CF. For example, changes in hepatic function to look for changes in cholestasis or hepatic injury or for fibrosis. Or changes in the endocrine. We've already seen improvements in growth with the ivacaftor experience. Might we also see changes in the endocrine pancreas function or bone health? Those sorts of questions. Another prominent one is to really address, can a different drug combination also recapitulate the experience with ivacaftor in helping clear out Pseudomonas and other deleterious organisms that affect the lives of people with CF? Well, one of the complexities, I started with that relatively simple cartoon that laid out the mutation class system on how we think about a CF, but it's actually quite a bit more complicated than that. This was pointed out by Veet and colleagues from Gary Cutting's group that showed that if you map mutations and put those mutations into various classes, almost none of the mutations, are really a pure class one or a pure class two or a pure class three. They all have multiple properties of dysfunction. And it suggests that we really need to be prepared to understand how various drugs might work together on an individual basis, and especially for mutations in which these drugs are not yet approved or in which are so rare that approval studies will really be much more challenging to commence. One of the things that will serve as a key landmark to this is the continued emerging experience at looking at cell culture response, shown on the x-axis, CFTR function measured in the laboratory with human cells, compared to what's ultimately achieved in the clinic in a clinical trial data. And already with this experience, the published experience with the approved drugs, you can see that we can start to get a relationship particularly at this moderate end of the scale of CFTR function, and begin to predict that if you get higher and higher on the scale, on an individual level even perhaps, we can expect a more and more prominent improvement in their lung status. So that's really been one of the guides, and to try and apply that, there's really two major technologies that are going forward, although there's quite a few others. Those are the two that are most prominent. One example is that we can harvest cells from the nose. Now the nose has a lot of the same features of the CF lung, and it's, of course, it's easy to access, and although it's somewhat an uncomfortable brushing procedure to acquire those cells, it's certainly something that you can walk away easily from. I've had it many times myself. And what we've seen in patients with the G551D mutation, in these data garnered by my colleague Marty Solomon, is in these individuals we can measure in the laboratory in their cells improvements in their ion transport or CFTR function, improvements in their airway liquid levels, improvements in the mucociliary transport rates when we apply the same drugs in the clinic to these laboratory specimens. And subsequently, then you can look at the relationship between the CFTR function we see in the cells and the CFTR function we see in the clinic and start to develop this linear relationship. Clearly, there's a lot of variance here, especially at the lower end of the scale, but as we move higher and higher up the scale, we're starting to see this start to smooth out. The same is true for lung function, and really points out that this might be ultimately a tool that we can use. We can take cells from an individual, whether it's nasal cells like shown here, or other technologies to take skin cells and grow them into lung cells. Those are also developing. And then test multiple agents on them, pick the best one for the individual, and then see if it generates response in them. Those sorts of studies have actually been done by our group and others. For example, before the P67L mutation, which is now approved for both ivacaftor and tezacaftor ivacaftor, we tested it in an individual because we thought they were likely to respond. We showed that they responded in the laboratory and then were able to get it in the clinic, and they went on to benefit from that. We've also seen very small levels of function seen with the W1282X mutation based on some unique properties of that mutation where it reaches the cell surface. And we've also begun to do even more sophisticated designs taught by some of our colleagues at UCSF who also had very similar experience. In this case, we were combining Adalorin with ivacaftor. Adalorin is a drug that's really directed towards class 1 mutations or nonsense mutations, and we built upon an open label extension study applying avacaftor on on-off periods to try and ascertain if they could improve. And what you can see is that when avacaftor was added to the regimen, we started to see improvements in lung function as well as improvements in their sweat chloride tests and improvements in laboratory specimens, really suggesting that classes that have not of drugs for mutations that have not really been studied together widely in the clinic have some promise on an individual level, and maybe that is one future that we can look towards for individual CF with difficult to treat mutations. Another example is to look at translational read-through for a large group of patients with nonsense mutations and to use a different tool with a similar sort of concept, and that is organoids. So these are cells derived from rectal biopsy specimens from people with CF. They will grow into these balls that then swell with fluid secretion. We'll hear a bit about those sorts of assays later today by Martina Gensch. And what you can see is that when you apply a read-through agent that corrects this class 1 mutation, that you get more swelling. The balls are essentially larger, and you can see those sorts of dose-dependent findings there. That would then, we can then project upon that the potential to combine this with other agents if needed to then augment those responses further. And you can imagine what that might be going forward in the clinic. And of course, right now this is a laboratory compound, but it's moving forward in clinical trials for in particular the G542X mutation as a first test of this mechanism. Well, one of the things that's highly motivated us in the CF Center where I work is to try and intervene on the mucus problem. And this is one of the areas where there's been the most advances in our understanding of CF pathophysiology, and then I think essentially opportunities to intervene. And we can expect to see the an agent that might benefit on this concept of the mucus problem would be expected to benefit all individuals with CF because it's really independent of their underlying CFTR mutation. What you're looking at in this video is really the thousands of beating cilia, or these hair-like projections on the surface of a trachea, and how they function to work together and then immobilize and transport mucus from the from our lungs. This is a donor from an individual who's healthy and didn't have CF. This is really a completely dysfunctional process in people with CF and where we might intervene. We knew that this could be an important target, again, from the ivacaftor experience. As I play this video, here you can see the outline of an individual with CF's lungs. This is their left lung and their right lung. This is their stomach. And you can see that the particles are really stuck in the lung. However, after they take ivacaftor with the G551D mutation, you can see that mucus flows much more robustly outside of the lung. And additional quantitative data have shown that is really a prominent improvement and seen across, even better than some inhaled drugs with CF. So it suggested, again, if you can flip the switch, you can make mucus more normal. To really investigate the cellular biology of this more precisely, we helped co-invent a technique with our collaborators at Massachusetts General Hospital and the Wellman Center for Photomedicine, an imaging technique called micro-optical coherence tomography. This is really a laser equivalent of an ultrasound. So we'll take a laser, apply it to cells, or in this case, organ tissues, and then look to see what it tells us about the mucociliary transport apparatus. And using a laser, we can get much more resolution and video rate of the epithelial function. Here you can see a single layer of epithelial cells from a normal piglet versus a piglet that has CF. Above that, you can see the cilia beating in a coordinated fashion. And for those of you in the front of the room, you can even see the mucus moving from left to right across the screen as they transport in a coordinated fashion. The individual, the CF piglet, you can see that airway surface liquid is depleted. The area is more white and bright because the mucus is more viscous. And in fact, the cilia don't move quite as well, and mucociliary transport rates in these CF piglets is almost a nil. So even very early in life, this mucociliary transport apparatus is going wrong in a piglet with CF, and it suggests the potential to intervene. One of the strengths of the technique is we can look at these measures in a co-localized fashion. Here we see the level of fluid or pericillar layer fluid on the x-axis and the level of mucus transport on the y-axis, and those are highly correlated. The more fluid, the better the mucus moves in the normal situation. But in CF, the system breaks down. Even in areas where there's appropriate levels of hydration above 7 microns, the mucociliary transport is severely dysfunctional in the CF piglet. And that suggested there might be something wrong with the mucus itself. We'll do building on the work of Paul Quinton, who's here in the audience, and others that suggested that bicarbonate may be a key aspect of this mucus problem. We then looked at depleting the bicarbonate, in this case of human cells, but we've also done this in human tissues and pig tissues, to show that when you take away the bicarbonate, but not the other aspects of the fluid transport 3 CFTR, you really increase the viscosity and make it indistinguishable from the CF situation. And that's really suggested that, again, viscosity or the thickness or adhesiveness of the mucus in CF is a major problem over and above the effects of hydration. We've developed a CF rat model, and Susan Burkett from our group has been working in this area to show that one of the unique aspects of a rat with CF is that it doesn't have glands early in life, and then it develops glands over time later. As it develops glands, it's over time, including in the CF situation, it starts to develop obstructions of the glands that really weren't observed early in life. So this really it seems to be a gland-dependent phenomenon that is occurs as more and more mucus is expressed in the CF situation. Even when airway surface liquid depletion is present early in life, It's not until these glands develop that the mucociliary transport collapses. Again, another major indicator that mucus is complicated, that it's changing over time, and that it, in itself, beyond effects of hydration, may be an abnormality to target. We've also shown that it's only after this mucus problem develops that CF rats can become chronically infected. Even with a single instillation of Pseudomonas, they can become chronically infected and sustain it for 28 days. There's really no other rodent animal model that does that, and we think it's because it has the mucociliary transport defect that's predisposed by the glands, as opposed to one-month-old CF rats where they're able to successfully clear their Pseudomonas. Well, despite applying these tools to laboratory animals, our ultimate vision when we moved to develop micro-OCT to understand the mucociliary transport apparatus was to ultimately apply this to humans. And we've now begun to do that. It's the only technology that can measure the mucociliary transport apparatus at the cellular level, to our knowledge, in vivo. This is a picture of the first clinical OCT system and a close-up of the probe. We can put it into people's noses without sedation or analgesia. It takes about 15 minutes to get the sort of videos that I'll show you. So it's something that we can do over and over again. As we imagine applying new drugs to individuals with CF to see if it fixes their mucus, now we potentially have a tool to help monitor that over time. What we found as we looked at people with CF compared to healthies, here's again that very that single cell monolayer, the cilia are beating above it. You can see a thin layer of mucus. It's almost black. It has a few white particles in it as they move on by. Whereas even the nasal airways of individuals with CF have this thick, white, highly reflective blanket of mucus. When we first saw it, we called it the starry night because of all these circles within that mucus. You can see the cilia are beating beneath it, but are doing so in a very frustrated fashion. When we quantitate measures, they have the airway dehydration measured as the PCL depletion. They have abnormal cilia beating, and they also have a significant disruption in their mucociliary transport rate. We can also see the sorts of linear relationships I put forth from our animal models is also present in humans. The more hydration, the more mucus is moving. The more cilia are beating, the more mucus is moving. However, these findings of these relationships is generally consistent with what we've seen in the laboratory. However, we've also seen that these sorts of hydration levels don't explain all the problems that we're seeing in individuals with CF. And in fact, we can see prominent abnormalities beyond that. This is an example of 15 images from 15 different individuals with in our study. The top five are normal, the bottom 10 are individuals with CF. And you can see there's very stark differences, like I pointed out on that original video. In the case of normal, there's always really dark or minimally reflective mucus. The epithelial layer looks very straight and clean. The cilia are beating in coordinated fashion. There's lots of cilia that are those bright sticks on the surface of the cells. Whereas in CF, we can see a variety of very prominent abnormalities. I'll point some out. One is the mucus looks very heterogeneous. Here you can see these streaking bands of mucus that have been reported in some animal models of CF. We can also see significant clumping of mucus. And in other cases, again, that starry night pattern that I just mentioned. You can see damage to the epithelial surface, so there's complete disruptions in the cilia apparatus. There's accumulations of mucus where it's stuck to the surface that we don't see in normals. The cilia can be discontinuous. Even when the epithelial cells are okay, there's missing areas of cilia. And we also see these balls, which we've later come to recognize are actually inflammatory cells. So we can measure the amount of inflammation both in the tissues and in the mucus level, and have shown that that also corresponds to the severity of the CF problem in those individuals. And then finally, just like that picture of the CF rat, we can see a completely occluded mucus gland ducts with mucus that can't get out of the glands because it's stuck within it into the nasal cells. We've been able to show that, in fact, the amount of whiteness or brightness of that mucus is, in fact, prominent in individuals with CF. And from the clinical data, that it's elevated in terms of the brightness, which corresponds directly to the amount of viscosity of the mucus. So we now have an indicator for using this sort of tool in vivo to measure how viscous the mucus might be. And really points towards how we might then apply this. And again, returning to the work of Paul Quinton, who really put forth a major hypothesis in the field that one of the major roles of CFTR is to apply enough bicarbonate to the mucus at the time of its birth to make these mucus strands much more linear, whereas in CF, this doesn't happen. And these calcium molecules that really function as a divalent cation glue in a simplistic form of our understanding keep this mucus glued together. And so if that happens, then the mucus ought to be glued together and form these ball-like modalities, perhaps similar to the mucus that we saw in those OCT images. We've begun to use drugs to try and intervene on this process. Here's an example of a control mucin, or one of the major components of mucus that has this ball-like structure of strands. You can see it looks like a spaghetti ball that's tangled up. Whereas if you use a drug that functions to displace calcium from the mucins to allow it to take a more linear form, you can start to see these linear strands. That improves the viscosity when you apply this drug PAG to this purified mucin, reducing it prominently as compared to a vehicle control. You can do the same thing to sputum and get significant reductions in the viscosity by about a log fold when you apply this drug to the sputum expectorated from human volunteers with CF. And then when we take that same mucus or sputum and apply it to trachea, you can see that it moves much more laminarly, much more easily, and at faster rates. So this is now actually being developed as a potential therapeutic for individuals with CF with this new mechanism of combating mucus structure. We have some work in animals that suggest there's reason to be hopeful. Here's a ferret in John Engelhardt's lab at the University of Iowa that's completely occluded with this prominent white obstruction of its lung. When you wash it out, you can get some of the mucus out, but the lung itself stays bright white and completely occluded. However, if you use a drug like PAG to wash out that mucus and make it the more normal structure, you can see opening of the lung. This is really just a handful of ferrets we've been able to do these sorts of studies for. So we've also done it in CF rats. When we apply it to CF rats, you can see a vehicle control has a thick, white, bright mucus that's moving poorly, whereas this is moving faster. Here's wild-type mucus transport rates here, and with the drug, you can see you can get it to be about half normal as compared to those that got a vehicle control. So again, this will move forward in clinical studies to ascertain if it's helpful. In really the last 10 minutes of the talk, I'm now just going to throw out a bit of science that we're doing in the lab that suggests that the lessons that we're learning to individual CF can be applied to other diseases. And so it really points out that working as a community and really seeking to help the lives of people with CF, we also might have an opportunity to converge on other diseases. And I think these sorts of themes are important to the CF field because it will continue to engender interest from a broad community who are developing drugs, first hopefully in CF, and then perhaps beyond that, to maintain a strong scientific interest in the cure of CF. This is really brought forth by this editorial and review by John Fahey and Burton Dickey, who showed, really pointed out in this review, that CF relies on a spectrum of obstructive diseases, with asthma being the mildest variant, COPD being even more CF-like, and then CF on the full extreme in terms of the level of mucus obstruction and goblet cell hyperplasia and other inflammatory changes that are happening in the mucus in these airways. So we, particularly given the experience of CFTR modulator therapy, started to ask if COPD has a lot of similarities to CF, could the sorts of drugs that activate CFTR potentially have a role? One of the first studies that really suggested this might be the case is where we used the diagnostic test for CF, the sweat test, and saw that people with COPD or people that smoked had elevation in their sweat test. Now, this is well below the diagnostic threshold that you all know well of 60, but it did suggest that they had a substantial abnormality in the level of CFTR function, even though genetically they had normal CFTR. We also showed an association of the sweat test with chronic bronchitis. People with COPD have two problems. They have emphysema and they tend to have chronic bronchitis. Many people will have a mix. Those that had more chronic bronchitis, which is more CF-like, actually had the higher sweat chloride testing. And we've also showed a number of other findings that have gone on to support this, both in the lung and other tissues. So to really model this, we needed to seek a model organisms to really prove whether this phenomenon we were seeing in individuals was present. And we needed to do that in animals, so we had to think about the CF ferret or the CF pig. And as you know, I hail from Alabama, and we certainly know how to smoke a pig in Alabama. And when you come visit us, we'll tell you how to do that. But what we decided to do is apply this to a ferret model of COPD, and I think it's staged to make some improvements, and it has a number of assays available to it that are not true for other small animals of the disease. Many times I'm asked, do ferrets like to smoke? Actually, mice don't get addicted to smoking, but ferrets do. Here's actually a video, and they're in each of these burrowing creatures. They actually can be trained to sit in these tubes. When they exposed to smoke, they can do so calmly for a long period of time. However, when they become addicted, they can become agitated when the smoke is turned off. They're very happy to see us on Monday morning when they've gone the weekend without smoking. And it reminds me of this quote from Mark Twain: giving up smoking is the easiest thing to do in the world, I know, because I've done it thousands of times. We heard, I think, about Emily's experience of being exposed to smoke during her rock experience, and I want to show that the data that we've obtained in ferrets has suggested that giving that part of her career up is probably a wise thing to do. Cigarette smoking actually reduces CFTR function in these ferrets. You can see that occurs over time, over 6 months, and does so in a relatively prominent fashion. They have a delayed mucociliary clearance. This is a heat map of their lungs and the amount of particles that are retained. This is just like the sorts of data I showed you with ivacaftor in patients with G551D. And we can also see when we image those trachea, the similar sorts of mucus defects that we see in CF. They also get bronchitis that we can measure on CT scan, and that increases over time as we measure bronchial wall thickening. And they develop a cough. Rodents don't cough, but these more advanced animal models do. They develop a human-like cough that's worse in the morning that allows us to monitor them for improvement. They also have significant amounts of mucus. Here you can see this bright pink mucus that's in the cells and also in the glands that's more CF-like, and that a level of mucus accumulation is much more prominent in these small airways. Going on, one of the reasons that we got into this was to start to ask the question, can smoking be essentially a therapeutic target for drugs that turn on CFTR? If ferrets have CFTR dysfunction, if humans with COPD have CFTR dysfunction, albeit not as prominent, might a CFTR activator or potentiator improve things? And in fact, when we've treated these ferrets with a potentiator, you can see improvements in their mucociliary transport rate. That's really quantified here in those that received a vehicle versus potentiator for a month-long in vivo treatment study. We've also done the same sort of thing in cells and saw that airway surface depletion can be partially restored, mucus transport defects can be partially restored. And in an early phase clinical trial, we can see improvements in their sweat testing, nasal potential difference, CFTR activity measurements, and bronchitis score. We're now doing a much larger NIH-funded study to see if that can be then applied to individuals. I think I'll skip this slide for purposes of time and just summarize that treating the basic defect has become a reality and could soon be a very viable and effective treatment option for almost 90% of individuals with CF defined by genotype. These individualized precision-based approaches can be used to approach defects across a variety of other CF mutations that haven't been addressed. New imaging modalities are helping providing insight into the underlying pathogenesis and can be used as a tool to develop new therapies against the mucus problem. And then I briefly showed that acquired CFTR function is a specific phenotype of COPD that can be applied to others. So thanks again for having me. I know you're all committed to the CF problem. We thank you for your interest, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Just remind them a couple of things.
Thank you, Dr. Rowe. We'll now take your questions from the audience. Due to time constraints, we do ask you to limit yourself to one question per person, and please use the microphone up front. A volunteer will adjust the mic for you and clean it between uses.
Hi, thank you so much for the presentation, and thank you to CFRI for making the conference possible. My question is about the triple combo, and if we have any information about responders, which patients are more likely to respond, you know, that
kind of thing. Those data are being analyzed now and haven't yet been released, so there's a limited amount of I can say, other than I think it's quite fair to say that the response was prominent and it was global, and that the minimal function mutations are really treated as a group and will be subdivided into subcategories. But you know, the anticipation is that they will act similarly, that the F508del allele is really responsible for the response.
I had a question about the sweat chloride, the initial drop we experienced when we started ivacaftor. A drop from the low 90s to the low 70s, and then over time it crept back up to the mid 80s. Is there any understanding as to what that is, why it happens, and is that the trend?
The data that we've seen so far, and that's both from clinical trials that have lasted up to a year, as well as our post-approval studies that are independent of the pharmaceutical companies with the CF Foundation, that have gone up to 2 years of data, and we've started to analyze 5 years of data, suggests that the average improvement in sweat tests actually is quite consistent. It drops early with therapy. There's minimal change after you reach steady state for the drug, and on average, it doesn't change. Now, when you look at the plots by any individual, there's can be quite a bit of bounce. Typically anywhere between, you know, there's a lot of bounce that are 5 milliequivalents or so. There's less people that are bouncing by 10 milliequivalents or so. So what you describe really is not the expectation for what should be happening on the group level. You know, our experience in with these other diseases, which I highlighted at the beginning, in particular, smoke exposure and COPD, suggests that there are environmental triggers that can affect sweat testing, and we've shown smoking as one of them. But I suspect that there are other sorts of injuries that can also go on to impair CFTR function, and it would only make sense to me that a corrected CFTR will be much more sensitive than a CFTR that was that has the normal sequence. I think one thing we might start to ask ourselves is if people are drifting off their improvement level, and it's not just the sweat test, but it's a sweat test is abnormal and other drugs, other measures like lung function, for example, that we might start to ask, is there more inflammation? Is there some sort of environmental exposures that's affecting it? Obviously, adherence needs to be assessed. We published a report of an individual we were taking care of at our center that took a drug that interacted with ivacaftor. So she had G551D. She was in the very first studies, like Emily described, and had this great response. And I've talked about her before. But later, she got a new infection. She was treated with an antibiotic called rifampin that interacts with ivacaftor. And the prescribers didn't realize it was going to interact with that. And it took her ivacaftor levels to near zero. And then she got super sick and from the withdrawal of the ivacaftor, not because she wasn't taking it, but because this drug interacted with it. So that's another reason to think about what your other medicines are using, or there are other inducers that you can take. One that we sometimes forget, for example, is the grapefruit juice and several oranges. So something you could be eating, you know, here at breakfast actually can influence ivacaftor levels, and that could be another reason. So hopefully I gave you some things to think about there. Next question.
My question's related to something you mentioned where pancreatic function gets restored in some people. Longer term, what research is being done to try and address like bronchiectasis and all the damage that's been done to patients' lungs and organs from having CF before getting onto modulators?
I understood the what you said, but I didn't get the question.
Yeah.
Part.
So, what research is being done to address damage?
Oh, got it. So, starting with the pancreas, what I would say is, these prominent effects of CFTR modulators are really challenging our preconceived notions about what organs can be fixed and what isn't. Many thought the pancreas, even at 2 years, ought not to be able to be responsive. And the clinical data suggests that, in fact, in some patients, somewhere between 30% and 80% of individuals who are 2 years old could have a very good response, and to the point where they might not be nearly as dependent on pancreatic enzyme therapy. So that's true for the pancreas. What about the lung? Well, there have been reports of people that are on a highly effective CFTR modulator where their level of bronchiectasis starts to improve. On average, that does not seem to be the case. But there are individuals who have had more prominent repair processes that can be detected by CT scan than what we would have otherwise expected. So that really, I think, throws forth the hope that if we can get the environment right, and perhaps use other tools, that organ repair might in fact be something that's possible. I think it's going to be a tall ask because the lung can't naturally repair itself from many of the injuries that occur to the CF lung. But one of the major kind of thought processes on that is to develop cell-based therapies or repair cell therapy that they can be instilled. But I think that's still 5 to 10 years away before we can expect that to be in the mainstream.
Concerning the CRISPR technology and actually repairing the DNA, are you aware of any research going on specifically towards CF and CRISPR? And for example, I was reading that Vertex is participating in a study with sickle cell anemia, and they've actually had success at curing sickle cell anemia in certain patients.
Yep. Gene editing technologies are all over the lay press and are being applied to a variety of diseases. CRISPR's one of them. There's quite a few others that are out there that can do that to repair the gene. It's the ultimate vision for people with CF is that a one-time cure can be achieved. And I think the development of CFTR modulator therapy and the feeling that we'll soon cross an important threshold in the number of patients that are eligible to that, that is the next frontier for CF research. So I the CF Foundation, other organizations are really pushing gene editing and therapy. In fact, we're writing a grant with a group in California right now to try and apply gene editing technologies to CF and using our CF rat model. So we're going to see much more on that. Why progress in sickle cell disease, and perhaps you've heard of eye diseases also being approved for certain early forms of gene therapy? Are they a little ahead of us? Well, the lung is a much more difficult gene editing target than the bone marrow. One of the key things, for example, in blood diseases is you can get the blood cells out, you can repair the blood cells in a test tube, you can pick the ones where it worked, you can get rid of the ones where it didn't work, which is actually a big part of the problem right now, is that it works in a small percentage of cells, that you can then purify those, maybe even expand them in the lab, and then put them back into the individual who has sickle cell disease. And that's really how that's being done for bone diseases, and we're going to see a variety of other bone diseases where that's been done. Bone marrow diseases where that's being done. The eye is also an easy organ to access. There's not a lot of immune system to break down the gene targets. So that's why eye is really ahead of the lung. And the lung is exposed to the environment. The lung is exposed to everything that we inhale, and it's got a lot of defenses to block out abnormal genes and viruses and bacteria and everything else we inhale. So that's why it's a more challenging target, but one that I think will be accomplished, because there's research in how to deliver these sorts of genes and then also how to edit them more efficiently. So I think it's going to get there. Even, I think I worry, and I think some in this field, CF worries, is that the success that's hopefully about to be achieved will make people run away from the people that are remaining. But even the people that are remaining are a large number compared to the other genetic diseases where gene editing technologies are being tested. So I think CF is still going to be a fertile ground for the most cutting-edge, advanced research for gene editing, and we'll certainly be in it for a while.
So I have this question from Marilyn, who is joining this conference remotely. After the month-long trials, are the poor ferrets allowed to live the rest of their lives in peace?
Yeah. It's really hard. It's really hard. I can tell you that we go an extra mile to make sure our ferrets are well taken care of and living as good a lives as they can. It's very motivating to me that for example, COPD is the third leading cause of death, and the therapies are terrible. So we've got to make progress.
You touched briefly on translation read-through and ELOX. Can you elaborate a bit more on what progress has been made in the search for new agents, especially in Alabama, at Southern Research, and other places?
Yeah, so there are multiple people screening for read-through agents. Some of them are not public, so I'm not gonna talk about those. One that is the program that we've been doing that's funded by the CF Foundation and in collaboration with Southern Research. We've had a long interest in this because my colleague, David Bedwell, really was the one that discovered translational read-through as a therapeutic approach for human diseases, and with CF being one of the first that they worked on. So we're finished our first high-throughput screen, and we found a number of chemical matter that were causing read-through. We were able to optimize those, actually showed some read-through in primary cells. But we don't think that particular molecule has the legs to go forward all the way to human studies for people with CF. It might for other diseases where the amount of restoration is a little easier to achieve. So we can imagine doing those that would really set the benchmark for read-through as a potential approach for human diseases and moving forward. And then secondly is we are in the midst of a second screen with yet a new technology that is revealing a lot of chemical matter to go through. And so we'll start going through what we've discovered on those hits and see what might have legs, and hopefully get one that not only does what our first generation compound did and cause read-through in CF cells, but also do so to such a level that we want to take it forward.
Hi, thanks for your talk. I'm Emily Godfrey at the University of Washington. And my question has to do with, for those of us in states where marijuana is legal, and it has been legal in Washington State for about 6 years, I'm noticing that my patients with chronic disease, including CF, are using marijuana often to help treat pain and to help with sleep. And I'm just wondering, given all the research that you've done around smoking, if you think that we will be able to extrapolate some of the work you've done with, I'm assuming, nicotine smoking to marijuana smoking, or if you think it needs to be studied separately.
I'm certainly not an expert in this area, and we've never studied alternative, agents besides cigarette smoke. With the exception of e-cigarettes, we have looked at e-cigarettes and believe that it also causes CFTR dysfunction, so we don't think that's going to be a safe alternative for people, especially people with CF, despite, marketing otherwise. So I think that is one important lesson that we've learned already. We've never looked at marijuana, but we know that some of the constituents that cause the CFTR problem are not just nicotine. Nicotine is part of it, but there are other, actually even more potent molecules that are generated by the combustion process, whether that's a vaporized combustion process or a burning of a cigarette combustion process. So I would anticipate that the same molecules are in marijuana smoke. I would advocate that if you're an individual with CF and you need to have, THC is the active constituent of marijuana as part of your regimen, that there are other ways to consume it that would be safer alternatives.
Hello. Could you explain why other class 2 mutations might not work with these therapies where the F508 does?
Yeah, so very active area of research. There is a handful of class 2 mutations that are similar to Delta F in that they misfold, but do or don't respond to CFTR modulators. Like one of the prominent ones is N1303K, which is in the top, I believe, 5, if not 10, of most frequent mutations in CF. So there's a ton of work happening right now to classify the top, I think it's about 100 mutations that are in terms of prevalence, and march through every one of them and see if any of the approved drugs work, including the ones that are in development like elexacaftor, but also by other companies. We have those efforts happening in the US, and we have organoid-based efforts happening along those lines in Europe. And what I can say is, I believe, I've seen data, but I'm not the right person to report them, there are other mutations in the class 2 sector that are responding to these sorts of drugs. So I foresee additional progress in the area. One of the other key things that I think is a transformative nature of the field that I really didn't get into is that the FDA decided to use cell-based data to help increase the labeling for CFTR modulators that have a proven track record in the clinic. So that will definitely allow shortening of timelines to get drugs for other mutations. And I expect to see that for certain mutations.
Two questions in my mind. One is that list of 100 or so mutations available to the public?
It's not been published yet, but it is being used in collaboration with various corporations that are developing these CFTR modulators to help stimulate that to go forward, and I expect it to be published.
And the other thing is, are you using cells? Are they using cells of CF people to actually test these?
Ultimately, that is always the vision. Some of the rarest cells are hardest to get. So the bulk of the work that I'm speaking of are cell lines that are engineered to resemble the primary cells. But I think anytime primary cells are available that can be used to validate those findings, there is strong interest in doing so.
Okay. If you ever need volunteers, if there's ever any need for volunteers, is that something that you would address to us?
Yeah. So one example of that, also led by the TDN and the CF Foundation, is called the Rare Study Initiative, and it's a particular to like get people right now with double X, and we'll soon expand that to other mutations. So you'll hear that from your clinicians and your clinical groups as we start to turn that. So we're getting experience with double X, and we needed it for all the discovery programs that are happening, some of which I mentioned, and now we'll expand further as it's prioritized.
introduction of Kalydeco and Symdeko and pancreatic insufficiency or sufficiency, prior to those medications, there was a lot of issues with blockages. So have you...
A lot of issues with what?
With blockages. Mm-hmm. Have you seen a marked improvement with the addition of Kalydeco and Symdeko as far as those symptoms going away or being less of an issue for the people with CF?
Yeah, good question. So DIOS, or used to be called meconium ileus equivalent of gastrointestinal blockage, is certainly a problem with CF. And it seems to be really CFTR dependent. There's a ton of CFTR in the part of the intestine where these blockages occur, and that's why it probably happens. We've done some work with animal models of DIOS and looking at these mucus agents that I spoke to, because the GI mucus is similarly defective, like the airway mucus that we've studied more commonly. And we've seen some effects on that and recently published that, and it's one of the agents that I mentioned in the talk. In terms of what CFTR modulators might do to that, that has not really been reported, and it's because the events are so rare and sporadic. So how to collect that information without watching people for many, many years is a challenge. So it may be something that comes forth as we continue to get experience. I haven't seen a ton of monitoring that. There have been animal models developed the G551D rat I haven't had time to speak to, but there are others that are like that. There's a G551D ferret that was just generated and published. And in those, when you give ivacaftor early in life, the ferrets, Dr. Engelhardt published that helped restore their GI tract function, including the blockages that ferrets tend to be born with when they have CF. So that all says, I think, that we're on the right track for helping reduce the incidence of that. It's certainly a devastating condition when it happens.